Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Islamic State claims Tunisia attack. 9 suspects were arrested. Islamic State group claimed responsibility Thursday for the deadly attack on Tunisia's National Museum that killed 23 people, mostly foreign tourists. The Islamist group's statement described the attack and was posted in an online forum that carries messages from the group. Earlier Thursday, Tunisian authorities said they had arrested 9 people in connection with a massacre at the Tunis Museum that killed 23 people. Security forces shot dead 2 gunmen at the scene of the attack Wednesday and said afterwards they were searching for their accomplices. Yemeni troops loyal to President Adrabu Mansour Hadi are reported to have regained control of the airport in the southern capital of Aden following an attack by forces loyal to former President Ali Abdallah Saleh. The battle is the latest in a complex fight among numerous parties for control of regional and national control. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Amateur video showed supporters of President Abdrabu Mansour Hadi exchanging fire and storming Aden Airport. Rival troops had captured it early Thursday. The commander of the Special Forces base in Aden recently refused to surrender his post after he was fired by Mr. Hadi. A presidential spokesman said Mr. Hadi was safe and secure following the attack. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Authorities in Afghanistan say a suicide bomber has killed a provincial police chief in the capital, Kabul. This is VOA News. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said in an interview with NBC Thursday that the United States and Israel are each other's greatest allies and have no choice but to work together. Mr. Netanyahu has not spoken with U.S. President Barack Obama since the resounding win Tuesday by his conservative Likud party in Israel's parliamentary election. He expects the two leaders will be in touch soon. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry called Mr. Netanyahu on Wednesday to congratulate him on the victory. Islamic State militants may have committed war crimes and crimes against humanity in Iraq, including genocide against the Yazidi minority, according to a new report released Thursday by the UN Human Rights Chief. The document submitted to the UN Human Rights Council details killings, abductions, torture, and other violations described by more than 100 witnesses and survivors from attacks that took place beginning in June of last year when the militants swept through large areas of Iraq. It calls for the UN Security Council to consider sending the situation in Iraq to the International Criminal Court, as well as for the Iraqi government to conduct public investigations of any alleged rights violations. A U.S.-based rights group says both government and rebel forces used cluster bombs in eastern Ukraine in January and February, killing at least 13 civilians, including 2 children. Human Rights Watch said Thursday that neither side in the conflict should be using such weapons and warned that their use could constitute a war crime. Spokesman for the rights group said not only do the weapons affect a large area when detonated, which endangers civilians, but unexploded munitions remain dangerous to civilians long after the attack. Investigators said they documented use of the bombs by both sides in the conflict. 3 of the investigated areas were in government-controlled territory, and 4 were in rebel-held areas. Top Democrat in the U.S. House of Representatives says a bipartisan group of hundreds of lawmakers is sending a letter to President Barack Obama requesting increased congressional weight in the ongoing talks to reach a nuclear deal with Iran. A draft of the letter, referred to by Congressman Elliot Engel, emphasizes that permanent sanctions relief, which Iran has repeatedly requested during the Geneva negotiations, would require new legislation. A staff member for Engel, the ranking Democrat on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, said 363 members of Congress signed the letter. A group of 47 Republican senators last week sent a letter to Iranian leaders warning any deal could be reversed. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
A senior UN official says violence and conflict in northeast Nigeria is increasing insecurity in the Sahel and threatening progress in the region. In an exclusive interview with VOA, Regional Humanitarian Coordinator for the Sahel, Robert Piper, says the United Nations is forced to divert funds from humanitarian needs to the protection crisis triggered by the militant Boko Haram.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. Details coming up.
Also, Tunisia's health minister says the death toll in yesterday's terrorist attack on the nation's largest museum has climbed to 23, and Chad has circulated a resolution to the UN Security Council for a five-nation regional force in West Africa to counter Boko Haram.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Lesotho, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the Islamic State group claimed responsibility today for the deadly attack on Tunisia's National Museum that killed 23 people, mostly foreign tourists. The Islamist group's statement described the attack as a blessed invasion of one of the dens of infidels and vice in Muslim Tunisia. It was posted in an online forum that carries messages from the group, and the U.S.-based site intelligence group reported the message appeared to be authentic. Earlier today, Tunisian authorities said they had arrested 9 people in connection with a massacre at a Tunis museum that killed 23 people. No details about the suspects were immediately disclosed. Security forces shot dead 2 gunmen at the scene of the attack yesterday and said afterwards they were searching for their accomplices. The slain gunmen were identified as Yassine Labidi and Hatem Kachnawi. Witnesses said they had been shooting at tourists outside the National Bardo Museum and rounded up others as hostages. Among the dead were 20 foreign nationals, tourists, and 3 Tunisians, government officials said today.
The target of the attack was the Parliament and the National Museum. Parliament President Mohamed Annansour said, These are symbols, and this attack was a message to tell us that terrorism today has changed in that it has a presence in the city and is eyeing our national symbols. The shooters were wearing military-style uniforms when they hunted and chased down tourists at the museum. Prime Minister Habib Esed said 3 Japanese were killed. Other foreigners among the dead were from Germany, Italy, Poland, Spain, and Colombia. Tunisian television showed images of older tourists and children fleeing the scene under the cover of armed security forces. A spokesman for the Interior Ministry said at least 100 people were inside the museum at the time of the attack. In a television address to the nation late yesterday, President Beji Said Espessi said, "I want the people of Tunisia to understand firstly and lastly that we are in a war with terror and these savage minority groups will not frighten us."
Chad's ambassador to the UN, Mohamed Zene Sherif, circulated a resolution to the Security Council yesterday. It requests endorsement of a 5-nation regional force in West Africa to counter the forces of Boko Haram in northern Nigeria. More than 10,000 have died and 1.5 million have been displaced in Boko Haram's violent campaign to create a caliphate in Nigeria's northeast. Sherif says he hopes for UN approval of the force by the end of March. The resolution calls Boko Haram a serious threat to international security. The resolution calls for the Secretary General to create a trust fund for international donations to be administered by the AU. It also asked the council to consider sanctions against any entity that supports Boko Haram. Finally, the resolution requests international donations of equipment and intelligence for the force, which will be headquartered in N'Djamena, the capital of Chad.
Forces from Chad and Niger claim to have retaken the city of Damask this week. Damask is Nigeria's Borno state, and it's on the northern border with Niger. Units from Chad, Niger, and Cameroon have been fighting Boko Haram in the Lake Chad area for several weeks. Nigeria's military this week claims to have retaken towns and cities in two northeastern states, Adamawa and Yobe. An army spokesman said he hopes to retake three remaining cities in Borno soon. The nation's March 28th national elections had previously been postponed because of the violence. President Goodluck Jonathan, who has been criticized for a failure to rein in Boko Haram, is running for re-election against Muhammadu Buhari, a former president and military general. Today, Jonathan swore in eight new ministers to his cabinet, less than 10 days before the vote. He said, it's like bringing in a player when the match is about to end.
A senior UN official says violence and conflict in northeastern Nigeria is threatening security in the Sahel region. In an exclusive interview with VOA, the United Nations Regional Humanitarian Coordinator for the Sahel, Robert Piper, says the UN is scrambling to raise money to respond to the protection crisis triggered by the militant group Boko Haram, without diverting funds from other humanitarian needs. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
UN Sahel Coordinator Robert Piper says the situation in northeast Nigeria is unraveling rapidly.
It's the issue that keeps me awake most at night in my current role. Over a million people are displaced inside Nigeria, but also hundreds of thousands of people have now crossed the Nigerian border into neighbouring countries. And they're moving into some of the poorest communities in the world. So there is a massive protection crisis unfolding before us in Nigeria. And we are scaling up all of our resources, our operations, not only in northeast Nigeria, but in Chad, Cameroon and Niger to respond to this massive crisis.
The United Nations recently launched a $2 billion appeal to provide humanitarian assistance in 2015 for millions of people in nine countries across Africa's Sahel region. The amount of money requested is similar to that of last year. However, $250 million, which last year was spent on food assistance for millions of people and for other chronic emergencies, will be used this year to assist the burgeoning displaced population in the region. In what he calls a very disturbing trend, Piper says last year, 1.6 million people were either refugees or internally displaced.
This year, we start the year with over 3 million people internally displaced or refugees, either because of northern Mali, the spiraling situation in northeast Nigeria, or indeed from Central African Republic or Darfur, which are themselves not part of the Sahel, but sending refugees into the Sahel seeking sanctuary.
Piper tells VOA the pressure on receiving countries is enormous. For example, he notes Niger, which is the poorest country in the world, is now hosting well over 100,000 refugees from northeast Nigeria. He says the picture is similar in Cameroon, which is hosting 60,000 refugees and more than 100,000 internally displaced people. He notes this displacement surge is threatening progress in countries such as Niger, which is establishing safety nets, food security, and nutrition programs. But he says these and other policy changes will take time to show results.
And meanwhile, around Niger's borders, we have the crisis in Libya to its north, the crisis in northern Mali to its west, the crisis in northeast Nigeria to its south. This is a pretty difficult neighbourhood for a government to operate in. They are inevitably moving money from their social accounts into their security accounts. We can hardly blame them for that.
Piper says the United Nations is watching this process with great anxiety. He says there is great uncertainty in this climate of insecurity whether the efforts Niger and other countries in the Sahel are making to improve the lot of their people will pay off. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Nigerians are set to vote in high-stakes elections on March 28th, but hundreds of thousands of Nigerians who fled the northeast because of Boko Haram are not sure if they can travel home to cast their ballots. Chris Stein reports from the city of Bauchi.
Hundreds of miles, numerous military checkpoints, and the constant threat of insurgent attack separate Fatoumatou Shagari from the ballot box. She fled to the city of Bauchi from the town of Maidigali in August after Maidigali was attacked by the Boko Haram insurgent group. She is now living with a relative and knitting caps for a living. Her voter's card, essential for casting her ballot, is in Yola, capital of the state she comes from, Adamawa. She does not know how she's going to vote. She says she does not have anything and needs food before she can travel. Most of Maidigali's houses have been destroyed, and most of the foodstuffs burned, Shagari said. She says she cannot travel until she has the supplies she needs. On March 28th, Nigerians go to the polls and choose whether to re-elect President Goodluck Jonathan or choose former military ruler Muhammadu Buhari. But the thousands of Nigerians who fled Yobe, Borno, and Adamawa states to the windswept neighborhoods on the outskirts of Bauchi are wondering if they will be able to vote. Aided by other African Union troops and foreign mercenaries, Nigeria's military has in recent weeks retaken most of the territory captured by Boko Haram during the past year, including Maidigali. But some towns remain in insurgent control, including the Borno state town of Gwoza. Retired teacher Buba Musa Shehu fled Gwoza when it was overrun in August. He is not sure it will be reclaimed in time for the vote. There is no place like home, he says, and he and his fellow displaced would really like to go back. But Shehu says he is doubtful that the government can retake the town in 3 weeks. Many voters in the northeastern states are expected to support Buhari's party, the All Progressives Congress. Until the party formed in 2013, Nigeria lacked a unified opposition front, and Jonathan's ruling People's Democratic Party easily overcame election challenges. The APC is expected to pose the stiffest challenge yet to the PDP's 16-year rule. Yeguda Idris is a librarian from Gwoza and a leader of a group of displaced people. He says he is concerned what will happen if Gwoza is not retaken in time for the vote. It is the right of all Nigerians to cast their vote, Idris says. But if some Nigerians cannot vote, then it is unfair and unjust. Nigeria's president says he hopes that Boko Haram will be driven from all of Borno State in the next 2 weeks. That would be just a few days after voters decide whether to give him another term or send him packing. Chris Stein for VOA News, Bauchi, Nigeria.
Coming up on 18 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. An Egyptian criminal court in Giza has acquitted former Interior Minister Habib al-Adli of corruption charges. As the top security official under ousted President Hosni Mubarak, al-Adli was accused of illegally amassing an estimated $25 million during his time in office. Al-Adli supervised Egypt's police force. Last year, he was also acquitted of charges he was responsible for killing protests during the 2011 Arab Spring protest that unseated Mubarak. Al-Adli was previously acquitted of other corruption charges.
A new report says there were both advances and setbacks in food security in 2014. Poverty was reduced last year and the number of hungry people declined. However, conflict, climate change and disease disrupted food production and trade. VOA's Jody Kepawa reports.
The International Food Policy Research Institute has released its Global Food Policy Report. IFPRI Director General Chengen Fan lists some of the accomplishments of last year.
We have achieved some progress. For example, we paid more attention to nutrition. We also think water hygiene are very important in solving children's malnutrition. We have also seen a new commitments on trade and climate change and focus on family farming. The year 2014 was a year of family farming. So we made enough progress on various fronts.
But Fan says 2014 had its share of threats to food security.
for example, persistent conflicts, re-emerging of zoonotic diseases, avian influenza, Ebola, and continued extreme weather shocks, typhoon in the Philippines, rising food safety scandals, Taiwan, mainland China, and beyond. Higher prices of nutritious foods such as vegetables and fruits, despite the very stable grain prices for the last 4 or 5 years.
Syria topped the list of conflicts in 2014 with its regional impact. Somalia and South Sudan are other examples of how conflict threatens food security for millions of people.
We have seen increased correlation between conflicts and increased malnutrition in many parts of the world. In the rest of the world, we have achieved tremendous progress in cutting hunger and malnutrition, although the level is still very high. But it is in some of the conflict zones, the malnutrition is actually rising.
Fan says climate change has long-term consequences on food security. He says there are still some skeptics, despite the overwhelming number of studies confirming its effects.
Increased floods, cyclones, droughts definitely should change their mind. And the extreme weather events will happen more frequent and more extreme. That will affect the ability of human beings in producing more food and more nutritious food.
The Global Food Policy Report says conditions for thousands of people fleeing violence in northern Nigeria, Central African Republic, and Mali were made worse by low rainfall and drought. It says that a lack of rain threatened the food and nutrition security and livelihoods of both hosting communities and refugees. The report adds the occurrence of both weather shocks and conflicts may not be coincidental, saying that abnormally high temperatures in Sudan and South Sudan strongly raise the risk of conflict. The IFPRI Director General says lessons about food security were also learned during the Ebola crisis.
The first lesson we learn is our global food system is very vulnerable to diseases. Ebola has huge impact on people's access to nutritious food. The production was interrupted, the market was disrupted, the trade does not come. For example, some of the rice exporting countries were very reluctant to send their grains to the Ebola-affected countries.
The International Food Policy Research Institute also says middle-income countries play a pivotal role in eliminating hunger and malnutrition. It says while Brazil, China, India, Indonesia, and Mexico may be rising economic powerhouses, middle-income countries are home to more than 360 million hungry people.
They are facing triple burden of malnutrition. Hunger, 50% of the world's hungry people live in these countries. Then lack of micronutrients, vitamin A, zinc, iron, and also increased obesity and overweight. So they are facing triple burdens. And the second burden, third burden, are rising very quickly.
The IFPRI report calls on governments of middle-income countries to reshape their food systems, to focus on nutrition and health, closing the gender gap in agriculture, and improving rural infrastructure. Fan says the report will be used to influence the writing of the Sustainable Development Goals. They'll soon succeed the Millennium Development Goals. He says there could be as many as 17 SDGs compared to 8 for the MDGs, and they could contain nearly 170 target areas. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Delegates meeting in Japan have agreed on a new framework for reducing the human and economic toll of disasters around the world. But critics say rich countries are shirking their responsibilities to help poorer nations deal with climate change. Henry Ridgewell reports from the conference venue in Sendai.
In the shadow of northern Japan's snow-capped mountains, Kazuhiro Watanabe's strawberries are plump and ready for picking. Because of his advanced glasshouses, the crop is ripe for harvest even in early spring. But the succulent fruit has proved difficult to sell in recent seasons, for Watanabe's greenhouses are in Fukushima, albeit a long way from the region's crippled nuclear power plant. I was in the middle of the strawberry growing season, he says, when the earthquake struck. After that, I lost half my customers. Watanabe says business is slowly improving. He says that, according to the latest surveys, sales of produce from Fukushima are now around 70% to 80% of the sales volumes of produce from other parts of Japan. So gradually, people's minds are changing. At the Fukushima Agricultural Technology Center, a team of workers in masks and laboratory coats is cutting and mashing fish, chicken and vegetables before they are put in the latest US-made radiation detectors. All local produce from the region is tested for cesium isotopes. Authorities say Japanese safety standards are 10 times stricter for levels of radioactive cesium than in the United States and Europe. The center's manager, Katsumi Komaki, emphasizes the international oversight of their activities. He says that they have cooperated with international organizations, including the International Atomic Energy Agency, in order to research the rate of absorption of radioactive materials by rice and other agricultural products. Next stop is a factory producing over 3,000 school meals every day, which are also tested for radiation. Samples are put in a blender before undergoing radioactive testing. Spokesperson Atsuko Kano says the process aims to be completely transparent. She says that they provide the test results on the Fukushima City website. They also send out information to every parent about the ingredients in the lunches. Fukushima is fighting hard to get back on its feet, and the region is using the arrival of thousands of foreign delegates to showcase its efforts. Local government official Mayumi Suzuki organized the tour.
The image of Fukushima is not really good in the world, but this is my dream that I want to tell all the people what's really happening in Fukushima, and that's why I'm organizing such a tour.
Independent monitoring from environmental groups has revealed hot spots of radiation in some areas of Fukushima, but no evidence of radiation in food reaching the market. In a region once famous in Japan for its produce, farmers and fishermen are desperately trying to reclaim the Fukushima name, still synonymous with the nuclear accident. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Fukushima, Japan.
Two more U.S. health workers have been evacuated from an Ebola treatment site in Sierra Leone for observation. They were flown by private charters to sites near one of three U.S. hospitals equipped to handle Ebola patients. Their arrivals bring to 17 the number of Americans who may have contracted the virus through contact with an American colleague who fell ill with the virus last week. The first evacuee is the only one of the 17 who has tested positive. He was flown to the U.S. National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, for treatment and has been in critical condition for the past 3 days. None of the workers has been identified. One other evacuee showed symptoms of the virus and on Tuesday was admitted to a biocontainment unit at the Nebraska Medical Center in Omaha, Nebraska. None of the other 15 have tested positive for the virus. They are isolated and being monitored for a 21-day period. All 17 are reported to have worked in Port Loco, Sierra Leone, for Partners in Health, a Boston-based nonprofit that operates health projects in several countries.
Also, Yehias, gender-based violence has increased in all three countries that have battled the Ebola virus disease for the past 12 months. In Guinea, the Minister of Social Action told a UN commission on the status of women that the number of rapes has doubled and other gender-based violence has increased more than 4%. Representatives of women's issues in Sierra Leone and Liberia said they have seen similar increases in abuse of women. The Liberian country representative for UN Women said because many of the care workers are women, they have been more affected by the virus. Women have an infection rate of 56% compared to 44% for men.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Nigeria heads to the polls March 28th for a landmark election. What happens there matters throughout Africa. Turn to Voice of America for the facts. VOA reporters are in Nigeria and surrounding countries covering the campaigns and the issues and counting down to the March 28th election and beyond. Special Nigeria Decides 2015 coverage is underway now. A commitment to Africa from Voice of America.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Chad has circulated a resolution to the UN Security Council for a five-nation regional force in West Africa to counter Boko Haram. Coming up, we'll have music from Lesotho, and in our feature segment, religious leaders in the north-central state of Kaduna are making plans to keep the streets calm after Nigeria's election results are announced. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuheap, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you have a Cricket World Cup update for us.
Kim, defending champion India thrashed neighbor Bangladesh by 109 runs Thursday to advance to the semifinals at the Cricket World Cup. Batting first at the Melbourne Cricket Ground in Australia, India compiled a daunting total of 302 for six, built on the back of man of the match, Rohit Sharma. Rohit, one of the most dangerous batsmen in the world, hit a dazzling 137. India joins South Africa in the semifinals, and the defending champions will face either Australia or Pakistan, who meet on Friday in Adelaide. The Proteas of South Africa, meanwhile, await the winner of Saturday's quarterfinal between New Zealand and the West Indies in Wellington. This marks the first time South Africa has reached the semifinals at the Cricket World Cup. And as South African captain A.B. de Villiers said on Wednesday's Sunny Side of Sports show, the ultimate goal for the Proteas is to lift the World Cup trophy on March 29th in Melbourne. In African youth football, here's a Sunny Side of Sports salute to the Flying Eagles of Nigeria, who are one victory away from their record-extending seventh African Under-20 title. The Nigerian boys beat Ghana Wednesday 2-0 in Dakar, Senegal. The Flying Eagles now await the winner of Thursday's semifinal in Dakar between Mali and host Senegal. Nigeria got goals in each half from Obinna Nwabodo and Musa Mohamed to book a place in Sunday's final. Speaking after the match, Nigeria's head coach Manu Garba said, and I quote, "The best team won. We created a lot of chances and could have scored more than two. Our objective is to be champions, and whether it's Mali or Senegal, we're ready for them."
The Voice of America.
Zimbabwe's recent expulsion from the 2018 World Cup qualifying competition marks a new low for football in the southern African country. World Football's governing body, FIFA, gave Zimbabwe the boot for failing to pay a former coach. Football and other sports have been in dire financial straits for years in Zimbabwe. Hope Chisuzu, a sports journalist in the capital, Harare, says the FIFA ban is the culmination of years of administrative problems.
This certainly has nothing to do with the ability to pay or not to pay, which would mean that this is an administrative issue. And there are several such administrative issues that are also causing more problems.
Zimbabwe sports journalist Hope Chisuzu says there will also be more problems now when it comes to Zimbabwe football development.
It could have very debilitating effects on our game. The fact that we won't be participating in the World Cup, it means there will be very little football that will be played downstream, meaning that most of our junior players, those in the age group 17 to 23, would certainly be affected.
Meanwhile, one of those expressing sadness over the FIFA decision is our African football guru, David Legg.
Well, as somebody who traveled extensively after independence in 1980 with the Zimbabwe national team, this is a particularly personally sad story for me. And I think to some extent, really unnecessary. There were good times in Zimbabwe. The money is flowing, but clearly it hasn't been invested properly. And now we're reaping the whirlwind. Things have got really bad, Sonny. It's so bad that some of the beds at the National Training Center just outside Harare have had to be sold to defray some costs. And apart from owing over $60,000 to the Brazilian coach, Valinov, there are a number of other debtors. ZIFA, which is the National Football Association, are really in dire straits. And my concern, Sonny, is that it's not going to end with this World Cup debacle. Zimbabwe are about to play Cameroon in the All-Africa Games qualifiers. They've got an Olympic Games qualifier coming up in the not-too-distant future against Swaziland. And there's also the issue of the 2017 Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers, the draw for which will be made in April. My immediate concern now is, will Zimbabwe be able to compete in any of these competitions, or will they be forced to withdraw from them all? And there was a warning signal, Sonny, just a few months ago when Dynamos, who are by far the most popular and most successful club in Zimbabwe, they were unable to enter the CAF Champions League this year, which to me, again, was a real tragedy because they're a team that have done Zimbabwe proud. But total lack of funds, they just could not even contemplate entering the competition. And if you go back, Sonny, 2004, after a number of heartbreakingly close attempts, Zimbabwe finally qualified for the Africa Cup of Nations, and among their results was a victory over Ghana. And they've produced some great footballers down the years. I mean, I think, for example, of that very charismatic Liverpool goalkeeper of a decade or so ago. Bruce Cobbler actually was born in Zimbabwe and played for the Zimbabwe national team. I had the privilege of traveling on numerous occasions around Africa with Bruce Cobbler. And it was such a joy because even in the darkest moments, even after the heavy defeats, he would light up the room, he would light up the island, the plane, with his comical behavior. And I think very professional, but at the same time, he didn't get down, he didn't get depressed when times were tough. And certainly, Sonny, a little bit of nostalgia creeping into my voice now. I miss those occasions, but yeah. Not good news at all, Sonny, and perhaps unnecessary in a way. You know, when the good times are rolling, that's the time to stack the money away. So when the hard times come, there's some spare cash. And right now, it looks like there's a very deep, dark hole that ZIFA have fallen down. And I think it's going to be a very difficult climb back up before they see some light at the end of the tunnel.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, commenting on some of the problems facing Zimbabwe football.
Hi, I'm Segun Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports, from the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
Game on, VOA sports fans. Our friend in Johannesburg, Mark Ouma, joins us now with an update on South Africa's national women's basketball team.
South Africa women overcame their limitations to recently qualify for the 2015 All-Africa Games and Africa Women's Basketball Championships, beating Zimbabwe and Botswana at the Africa Zone 6 contest in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe. Team manager Sibongile Maswanganye explains.
It was a good experience, and South Africa only played at the All-Africa Games in 1999 when we were hosting, and since then we haven't been playing into that competition because we haven't been qualifying. And also for the AfroBasket, the last time we played it was 2009 in Madagascar, and the competition was very tough. It has been difficult, and it has been dry for women basketball in South Africa. We don't have proper leagues that, you know, we are given a platform where we can develop the players. The only league that is there, it's school and at the tertiary levels. For us, you know, taking a team which has 7 rookies, it was a high risk. You know, nobody believed that we'll come back qualified. But nonetheless, you know, we promised ourselves that let's go out there and do our best and make sure that we come back with a ticket to both the All-Africa Games and the AfroBasket tournament.
Did you have any international matches to build up before you went to Zimbabwe? Remember, Zimbabwe were on their home turf.
And then we had about 3 training camps here at home. And one of the other camps that we had to travel to was to Mozambique. This was 2 weeks before we go to the qualifiers themselves. It was a good exposure for the young ones. Like, Mozambique's structure in basketball, I must say, is very tough. And when we were there, I mean, there was no day when we go to the courts and the basketball courts were just not being busy. I mean, from 9 o'clock in the morning until 10 o'clock at night, the courts are packed. I'm talking about from the age of 6 years old, 15 years old. You know, all age groups are there up until the seniors. Now, team, but then the clubs that we played, they were very strong. So we came back, you know, very strong and understanding that when we go to Zimbabwe, it's not going to be on the silver platter. So only one team needed to qualify. And the AfroBasket is a qualifier for the Olympics.
That was Sibongile Maswanganye, South Africa women's basketball team manager, speaking in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Thanks, Mark. That's our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma, reporting from Johannesburg. Still with basketball, one of the most popular sporting events here in the United States, the men's NCAA Division I championship basketball tournament, has tipped off at arenas all across the country. The single elimination competition will culminate April 6th when a new national champion is crowned in Indianapolis, Indiana. The defending national champion, Huskies of the University of Connecticut, did not qualify this year. The top seeds for 2015 are Duke, Wisconsin, Villanova, and Kentucky, which is bidding to become the first team in almost 40 years to go undefeated and win the trophy. The last team to do it was the University of Indiana in 1976. Kentucky won 34 consecutive games during the season, and they'll begin the tournament later Thursday night when they play the underdog Pirates of Hampton University, which is located in the state of Virginia. Because of the sometimes crazy upsets that occur in the early rounds, with small schools knocking off bigger ones, this tournament is affectionately called March Madness. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, religious leaders in the northern state of Kaduna making plans to keep the streets calm after Nigeria's election results are announced. And next, we focus on Kenya, the top 20 fastest-growing economies in the world. But first, some music. Here is L.A. Frobs from Lesotho with Spiral Aloe.
Nouvelle kibimba nanga bisakiri kumbutu mineri bada sukiri kulondi kyamfu kibwi dibale kibiesi bisukiri eh hey, ya mema mambu
Soto's L.A. Frobs with Spiral Alaway.
Well, Nigeria's Middle Belt has long been the site of fighting between Muslims and Christians, as well as between people of different ethnic groups. As the elections approach, community and religious leaders in the north-central state of Kaduna are making plans they hope will keep the streets calm after results are announced. Chris Stein reports from the state capital, Kaduna.
The city of Kaduna in Nigeria's Middle Belt is divided by more than just the river that bears the same name. Christians dominate the neighborhoods on the city's south side. The north is filled mostly with Muslims. Local leaders say the two communities usually get along. But after the 2011 presidential elections, rioting broke out in the city and in towns across Kaduna State. Muslims in the city fled Christian neighborhoods. Christians living in the majority Muslim areas did the same. So with Nigerians again heading to the polls to choose their next president, again pitting President Goodluck Jonathan against his main opposition challenger, Muhammadu Buhari, community and religious leaders say they are working to prepare people to accept the results of the election and to refrain from a repeat of intercommunal violence. So what brings Christians and Muslims in this religiously mixed city together? In the opinion of Alhaji Kabir Adanlade, it's football. Adanlade has been arranging games between young people from the majority Muslim neighborhood of Tudunwada and Christians in a neighborhood on the other side of the river.
For my own belief is the only way I can unite the youth is through football matches. Because if you can see all over the world, once there is football matches, you see how people unite together. They forget about their differences.
And those differences here are many, not just religious and political. Imam Muhammad Ashafa of Kaduna's Interfaith Mediation Center says conflicts between farmer and herdsmen, along with long-standing economic inequality between the north and south of the city, have played a part in fueling past violence.
There's a long history in the case of the southern Kaduna, a long history of perceived injustices, perceived political domination from the northern part against the southern part of the city.
Alhaji Alatu Alkali is the district head of Tudunwada. He says the root cause of the fighting in 2011 in his area was unemployment. With the district's youth unable to get jobs, many turned to violence to express their disagreement with the election's outcome.
Whatever election, there is supposed to be a winner and a loser. People tend to show their grievances. But the best way to show their grievances is formal. There are courts, there are law places that this thing can be, you know, taken to. But youth took it to themselves because, you know, if there is an unemployment and the youth don't have anything to do, whatever comes, they are ready or they just want to go about it.
Ashafa is hopeful that this time around, the preparations put in place over the years since 2011 will prevent a repeat of the violence.
We have hope that the 2015 elections won't come easier in Kaduna State, and it's tense, but the energy will be managed in a way with the system, if well used the system we put in place, it will be managed to go non-violently with a higher reduction of backlash.
Ashafa says the center has set up a regional council to monitor for threats of violence and coordinate responses by local, religious, or government leaders to ensure they aren't acted upon. Chris Stein for VOA News, Kaduna.
Kenya has emerged third among the top 20 fastest growing economies in the world, according to the 2015 survey by Bloomberg. Kenya and Nigeria are the only African countries that made it on the list, which placed China first, followed by the Philippines. However, unemployment in Kenya remains high, and some industries face a shock unless the U.S. renews a key trade agreement. Lenny Ruvaga has more on the story from Nairobi.
The sound of this industrial sewing machine fills the air at the United Aryan Limited Textiles Factory on the outskirts of Nairobi. Workers here are busy trying to make production deadlines. Established 13 years ago, the company employs approximately 10,000 people, earning an average income of $150 a month. Most of its business is in exports. Each month, it sends goods worth $100 million to clients in the United States. United Aryan has benefited from the African Growth and Opportunity Act, AGOA, a U.S. trade program that provides duty-free import of certain products from sub-Saharan Africa. But that all may change, with the program set to expire in September. Pankaj Bedi, the founder and chairman of United Aryan Limited, says his company would face serious consequences if AGOA is not renewed.
We all have been lobbying, pushing, doing whatever we can. In fact, government now is very proactive. Even Kenya government has been, you know, following through. If it is not there, then we are not there. We'll lose all the jobs. There will be social security, all kind of disasters happening.
According to the Bloomberg survey of 57 countries, Kenya's projected 6% growth rate this year would see it join China, India, Philippines, and Indonesia as the only economies enjoying 5% growth or higher. However, unemployment in Kenya remains high, and 40% of Kenyans live below the poverty line. Losing the trade agreement could make the situation worse. Financial analyst Ali Khan Sachu says AGOA adds jobs and revenues to Kenya's economy.
There's been an explosion in what is called the EPZ, export processing zones, where the government has assisted companies who are predominantly exporting textiles. Pretty major, and it has had a dynamic, positive economic impact in Kenya.
In the past, Kenya has struggled to attain strong economic growth due to political unrest, periodic droughts, and attacks blamed on terrorists. The business community believes fast growth can continue if AGOA continues as well. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi, Kenya.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Ruhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Audrey Rodriguez, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
45 years ago, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty entered into force. U.S. President Barack Obama said recently in a statement issued by the White House on the anniversary of the treaty. Thanks to worldwide collective efforts and commitment, the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty has become the cornerstone of the nuclear nonproliferation regime, reinforcing international peace and security and preventing the further spread of nuclear weapons while promoting the peaceful uses of nuclear energy. Today, the United States' nuclear stockpile has been reduced by 85% since the height of the Cold War. That is a level not seen since the 1950s. The United States seeks the peace and security of a world without nuclear weapons, President Obama said. The Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty remains essential today, and our efforts to achieve nuclear disarmament cannot succeed unless we stand together to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons and work for full compliance. The United States is meeting its Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty obligations and is committed to further strengthening the nonproliferation regime. The United States has reduced the role nuclear weapons play in our security and reduced the size of our arsenal, President Obama said. Our commitment to nonproliferation is at the center of our efforts. Along with our P5+1 partners to reach a diplomatic agreement that prevents Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon. The International Atomic Energy Agency plays a critical role in promoting the safe, secure uses of nuclear energy and technology, and in ensuring that it remains exclusively peaceful. We can only realize the full benefits of the peaceful uses of nuclear energy to advance development and protect the environment if we are confident that civil nuclear energy will not be diverted for weapons, President Obama said. As we prepare for the 9th review conference of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, the United States stands ready to work with other Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty signatory countries to achieve a successful outcome that reinforces the vitality of this treaty, which is so fundamental to global security.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
VOA News is always at the tip of your fingers.
All the news you want about Africa and the world, day and night, is available on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
Make it your first source of news and information.
As Nigeria heads to the polls March 28th, Voice of America reporters head to the field, covering the election campaigns and the issues for Nigeria and all of Africa. Turn to Voice of America for the facts. Nigeria Decides 2015. What happens there matters throughout Africa. VOA has the largest team of international journalists in Nigeria and surrounding countries, counting down to the March 28th election and beyond. VOA's Nigeria Decides 2015 coverage is on radio with Daybreak Africa, Africa News Tonight, and Nightline Africa. On television with Africa 54 and Straight Talk Africa. And stay on top online. Go to voanews.com. Special Nigeria Decides 2015 coverage is underway now. A commitment to Africa from Voice of America.